Greetings, g'day, kia ora. Welcome, yasu, this is Jeff Phillips Weverson coming at ya. Sitting here on the beach at Dripstone, which is a suburb of Darwin, Northern Territory. It's the late afternoon on Friday, the 25th of September. This show is in honor of the hundreds of beautiful little pilot whales that have just lost their life, and some of whom are continuing to lay there and suffer and trying to get pulled back out to sea or move on to the next dimension here on the west coast of Tasmania. It's been a gut-wrenching past few days. Just on Tuesday, we were practically celebrating the return of Mr. Humpback Whale up the Alligator River in the Kakadu. He went back out to the ocean on his own. And I really have to congratulate Carol Palmer and Feach Moyle, the two primary scientists that were working to help the whale. And they chose the best possible path by not doing anything at all. They were contemplating what Plan A and Plan B and Plan C were going to be. But they delayed doing anything. And that alone is what saved Mr. Whale, because I think that it was kind of a tricky situation in water. It was deep enough, but it was quite murky. Whales don't have sonar, as far as we know. All they do, although they do have good spatial orientation, according to Wally Franklin. But a lot of sandbars, a 6 or 7 meter tidal variation every day. And theoretically, anything they did to try to motivate Mr. Whale to go back to the ocean could have had the wrong effect. It could have scared him or startled him or confused him. It could have put him on the sandbar. And then they would have been faced with what to do with a whale that was stranded. He would have had to ride out, be in there until the next high tide came, and possibly be at risk of crocodiles. And anyway, all of this was miraculously avoided because of their forbearance and patience and letting Mr. Humpback Whale just return to the ocean when he was ready. And he did after 17 days. And it was just a miracle, and to me one of the coolest things that's happened between whales, cetaceans in general, and humans in Australia, because so often it's the case that it just goes the other way, that decisions are made often quite hastily and they just proceed with euthanizing the poor whale, even to the extent of grotesque violations of any kind of morals or ethics. To me, I don't care what they tell you about it being the most humane way of killing a whale. Strapping dynamite to its head or drilling a hole in its head and sticking a stick of dynamite in there and blowing it up while it's still alive. I mean, I think that the guy in Western Australia that did this is still alive and possibly still working for whatever department that is out there, but that's some extremely bad karma for that dude and for humanity as a whole. But in Western Australia, that really doesn't surprise me, because it's the most distant frontier of Australia, which is in itself kind of a frontier. And it was reading about a young Aboriginal man who was one of the practically countless Aboriginal deaths in custody. Young Aboriginal man in the Fremantle Jail. Fremantle's a suburb of Perth, who was shot by prison guards. Yet the jury ruled that the death was death by misadventure. Not first-degree murder, which it actually was, death by misadventure. And so that was my first exposure to that term, but I've seen it other places, like in New Zealand. If you're being operated on and a surgeon accidentally, while he's trying to take out your appendix, he slips and slices into your spinal cord and paralyzes you for the rest of your life, that's called a surgical misadventure. And that's a true story. I know a dude that happened to. And so misadventure, it's quite Orwellian, and it puts the onus onto the victim for sure. And sure, all these pilot whales in Tasmania, close to 500, sure, they did. They swam up there of their own volition, or else, unless they were already dead and then they got washed up there, which that's one of the questions that I have right now. So yeah, on Tuesday, just as we were applauding Mr. Humpback for being back out on his way and wondering if he was going to head west and come over towards where I'm sitting right now, looking out onto the ocean with the sun going down, or and continue over towards the Kimberley on their way down to Antarctica, which is where they believe he was part of a group doing. That's their normal routine this time of year, to go down there and feed on a bunch of krill, get their yearly dietary intake for the whole season. But anyway, just within an hour of the Humpback going back to the ocean, I got a message from my friend in Tasmania telling me about this stranding. And I've been sort of following it. Most of my waking energy has been dedicated to this ever since Tuesday, and today's Friday. But it was a very strange synchronicity that almost at exactly the same time, it was one of the coolest things ever to happen in Australia with whales, and one of the worst. And now they're calling it the worst cetacean stranding in the history of modern Australia. So both of these things happened almost simultaneously and on the spring equinox. So how weird is that? And it's very symbolic in many ways, but the main title of the show, On the Brink Radio, broadcast number 337, it's basically called Catalyzing Ocean Awareness. The whale stranding is a wake-up call for Tasmania and Australia. And I love Australia, and I love Tasmania. And Tasmania is my very favorite part of Australia. And I've been lucky enough to spend a lot of time there. Oh my God, a lot of time there in the past year or two. Like probably at least, out of the past year, I probably spent 8 months there over three different times. And it's really, really special. But even though it's just as much of a maritime environment as New Zealand, the most distant place, the greatest distance you can get from the ocean in New Zealand is about 110, 120 kilometers. And it's the same in Tasmania. The furthest you can get from the ocean is 110, 120 kilometers. That's like, if you had a highway, that's an hour's drive. It's not that far. So both places are extremely maritime. They're islands. And it just seems to me that in my 20 years of travel all around both islands of New Zealand, no matter where you are, people have some kind of connection with the ocean, even in the mountains down on the South Island. But in Tasmania, a lot of the people and a lot of the mentality seems far more landlocked and just sort of oblivious to the fact that the ocean might only be 30, 40, 50 kilometers away. It's like a whole different reality that doesn't even exist. And I think that this whale stranding, because of the severity of it in terms of the number of whales and the fact that people do like whales because they're magnificent creatures and beautiful animals. I'm sick of that, hearing that stuff. But it's getting a lot of attention, and Australia was already on the world map for whales because of Mr. Humpback, and now this. And so it's calling a lot of attention to the whales and dolphins in Tasmania. But now that the basic sort of gut level shock is subsiding, all the vultures are starting to rub their claws together and see how they're going to cash in on this. And it's already started with some of the politicians calling for investigations into what's happened. And as if whoever's doing the investigating is going to be able to do anything about it. I mean, this is all just political bullshit. And, you know, and all the euphemistically called non-profit organizations that are always soliciting money for save the whales and save this and that and help us do this and help us do that. I'll name names like Greenpeace, for example. They're always spouting off about climate change stuff. Sea Shepherd, they're actually not a nonprofit. They haven't been able to operate as a nonprofit organization for over a decade because a federal judge in, I think it's in America where they're actually licensed, a federal judge ruled there over a decade ago that they were making so much money that they can't operate as a nonprofit. So most people don't know that. But these organizations, their primary thing is soliciting money. And anything that they do, I mean, sure, Sea Shepherd's got some vessels, some boats that are each probably, you know, they're the equivalent of destroyers in the Navy. And that's another whole, the sort of the environmental degradation created by environmental organizations. That's a whole sort of little sub-branch of stuff that I sort of work on myself. Like, for example, when Greenpeace did a campaign in the Great Australian Bight about 3 or 4 years ago against BP, who wanted to do offshore drilling. But I talked to somebody that worked for Greenpeace, I forget their name, and they told me, because see, the Greenpeace boats use diesel, which is a hydrocarbon. And I go like, well, look, how much diesel is your boat going to use for this campaign? And he goes like, oh, about 1.2 million liters. And I go like, is that all? And, but think about it, 1.2 million liters of burning hydrocarbons in order to take a giant destroyer-class vessel right into a whale sanctuary area in order to protest against drilling for oil. Doesn't make any sense. And that's not the first thing Sea Shepherd has done that didn't make any sense in terms of that. But they did it. But then I had the interest to ask further to someone that was in a position to find out who Sea Shepherd actually bought their fuel from. And just because I asked that question, this person disowned me and has never communicated with me again because they were so heavily bought into the sacred devotee level of the Sea Shepherd fanaticism. Anyway, but so now all the governmental and NGOs are going to go to work with this whale and dolphin thing, trying to capitalize on it any way they can. And then you're also going to have the official whale operation rescue team there, which is a branch of what they call DPIPWE, the Department of Primary Energies and Water and Environment. They're working on their story for what the quote-unquote cause of this stranding was. Yesterday I called up and talked with a guy named Chris Carleon, who's the team leader of this rescue operation over there at Strawn. And he's somebody I'd actually talked to on the phone about 10 years ago. He remembered talking to me because I was trying to follow up and get in touch with a who I consider to be a top Tasmanian whale and dolphin person. Her name is Rosemary Gales. And I have to correct myself. In my radio show last week and in my blog post, I referred to her as Naomi Gales. But Naomi was an old friend of mine who was a chiropractor in Launceston. So it's not Naomi Gale, it's Rosemary Gales with an S. Anyway, she and her team successfully rescued 3 fully grown sperm whales somewhere down south in Tasmania that had been laying on the beach for 96 hours. That's like 4 days. They had been there, and normally mainstream science would have probably already euthanized them on the grounds that the common belief is that they their lungs collapse under the weight of not being buoyed up in the water and they wouldn't be able to breathe and stuff. But they were perfectly fine, and she and her team were able to refloat them, I think using some boats and stuff, and they were fine. And so that kind of blew that whole thing out of the water, the necessity of euthanizing whales that had been beached for 3 or 4 days. And these were huge, fully grown sperm whales. When a pilot whale beaches, he might be 3 tons and, you know, 4 meters long, but it's not the size of a sperm whale. And they would be able to lie there for several days. depending on the conditions of water, moisture, temperature, sun, rain, and stuff like that. So anyway, one of my questions to Chris Carleon was that on the first day of the stranding, when about a third of them were dead, or so they thought. I mean, again, this is information gleaned from a helicopter, I think. So they can't really be sure, but they were reckoning that a third of them were dead. But he specifically said in an article on, I think, in ABC, that it was great conditions, not so much for the people, but for the whales, and that they should be able to lie there and give them plenty of time over the next few days to rescue them all. So then, that was on Tuesday or Wednesday, but then yesterday, all of a sudden, it went from like one third of them being dead to like about 400 being dead, or like 80%. And so I asked him about that, and he was kind of in the middle of all this different stuff. I was glad that he took the time to talk to me, because they were in the field over there, and he didn't quite get around to answering that, but I'm going to find out more. But what I did ask him about was I had talked with my friend Terry Lilly, the well-known underwater photographer and marine biologist on the island of Kauai in Hawaii, who I've interviewed on my show 5 or 6 times. And he emphasized the importance of doing some necropsies that if we studied and looked for the right things in some of the dead whales, we might find evidence that pointed to what might have happened to them. Like, if you look for certain kinds of enzymes associated with the heart, that could indicate that they were adversely affected by some kind of electromagnetic energies or waves or shocks or something like that, like that Terry has experienced himself while diving. Also to look for elevated levels of nitrogen in the blood, which could have to do with rapid decompression that would result from them surfacing too fast because they were scared. And also for looking at their hearing apparatus and their inner ear, looking for evidence of acoustic trauma that could be from loud blasts of sonar or something like that, or explosions. So this is physical, organic, physiological evidence that you can be looked for. There's no way that you can detect if it was a behavioral or psychological trauma or trigger that might have caused them to panic or flee or something like that. But anyway, it's something important to look for. And you need to look at as many whales as possible and eliminate these as possibilities before then moving on to other things. So he said that no embolisms had been found. And I don't know how many whales they looked at. But anyway, I talked with another girl, Michelle Nickel, and she put me onto the team that's actually doing those necropsies, and they're supposed to get back to me. They might have emailed me by now. And so maybe by the time I write the blog post for this show on Sunday, I might have more information about that. But anyway, I'm doing another interview with Terry on Sunday too, and we're going to talk about all this stuff. In situations like this, it's also very important to distinguish between strandings that were live and strandings that were dead. Like if a whale washes up and it's already dead, that means it died at sea. And so that probably means that something killed it. And so this is another thing that I don't think is really being addressed with this situation. And so I'm trying to just get more information, not being there myself. I'll have more after these people tell me if they're going to share with me valid information or not. But there's a couple of things that we've got to realize, that they're government employees. And this really nice person who I got in touch with, who was a wildlife carer in Tasmania, said that she wouldn't trust anything that Dipipwi said, because she's ran into this before with them, her reporting incidents about animals being abused and stuff like that, and that invariably what they do, they're just apologists for the industries that the government works for, like oil, mining, fishing industry, and stuff like that. And so what they do, they try to marginalize any evidence that might point to adverse effects from anything that these industries do, and brush it off onto more nebulous things like, for example, climate change, or maybe even in the world today, coronavirus, or something like that. And so I've seen it a million times, and that's exactly what they do. They may not be consciously aware that they're doing this, but they know they're not allowed to mention naval activities, military operations, hazardous operations from rocket launches or torpedoes or anything like that, submarine, anti-submarine warfare, oil, seismic exploration. Maybe they could mention seismic exploration or naval sonars just a little bit, just in passing. But I do know what the story's going to be, because Chris Carleon told me that what they've decided is that a freshwater lens formed. Now, what that would be is a body of freshwater that came out of the mouth of the river there and out into the ocean. And the presence of this body of freshwater, which has a different density and different salinity and different ability to conduct sound and seawater, that the presence of this freshwater lens disrupted the sonar of these whales and caused them to strand. Now, but if you think about it, fresh water comes out of that river every day. That's what it is. It's a river dumping into the ocean. So, and they would have been there before and around other rivers, and so they know. They're not unfamiliar with fresh water coming out into the ocean. And then, but the main thing is that this harbor has a very narrow mouth, and it's got a little peninsula that juts around, and it could prove to be tricky for somebody navigating that didn't know what they were doing. But these whales have been doing this for millions of years. And anyway, but a lot of the whales weren't stranded out on the beach outside the harbor, but a group of at least 200 was found 10 kilometers, that's 6 miles, way up in the harbor. So the question is begged, how and why did they go so far up in there if they were completely disoriented and their sonar wasn't working because of the very fresh water that they would have been swimming more directly into by continuing into the harbor than staying out in the ocean? It doesn't make any sense. And the fact that they've gone so far, to me, the whole thing points to the fact that they were fleeing from something. They were trying to get away from something that scared them or terrified them. So what would they be fleeing from? Now, some people are going to say, oh, it could be an undersea earthquake. It could be some predators like some orcas or something like that. But anyway, I think it's pretty clear. I'd really like to thank my friends at Stranded No More for their brilliant work. Their work showed the presence of hazardous operations and space debris in an area within about a 500 kilometer radius of Western Tasmania. So what I believe it was is some kind of probably a combination of submarine and naval operations out there where we're not allowed to know about, and also in conjunction with a rocket or missile launch that took place from a place in South Australia called Coonabbin. And this is sort of not that far from Woomera, but it was a rocket launch out over the ocean. And I'd like to thank Ben Vigen of Postman Investigates for sharing this information too. He and I have interviewed each other on our respective shows. I ran into problems with him when I was trying to interview him, and I just asked him what his background was, what his credentials were that gave him access to all this information and stuff, and he got pissed off at me for just asking that. I didn't question them. I just asked what they were, and he goes like, how dare you? How dare you question my credentials and stuff? But I wasn't. I just wanted to know what they were. Anyway, a bit of a tricky person to deal with, but he posted a thing. He does love the whales, And so it makes a lot of sense. The map that Stranded Newton Moore had correlates with this. It's turning into a very beautiful sunset here on the beach. So anyway, I think it could have been a rocket launch and something that crashed down into the ocean, and it was being monitored by boats and submarines out there, and this in conjunction with other operations that could involve torpedo launches, weapons testing, missiles firing, surface-to-air missiles from out in there. Then you've got all different kinds of submarine activity, like autonomous unmanned vehicles and swarms of drones. This is all the sort of the leading edge in naval warfare. We've got Admiral Nirenberg telling us in 1968 that the militarized ocean paradigm looks at anything in the ocean that can cast a sonar signal is looked at as biological interference and something to be gotten rid of. And we've also got the viewpoint of Duncan Steele, the guy that wants to disseminate or infect Mars with genetically modified organisms. He reckons that it's okay for all these rockets and stuff to just drop harmlessly into the ocean, as if there's absolutely nobody there at all. So this is the mentality that we're up against. And a lot of this stuff, it's happening outside of our field of view. We're not allowed to know about it. We can't see it. We aren't allowed to know the location of nuclear submarines or even naval vessels. But what we do know is the aftermath of when they've been there. Because as Terry Lilly says, everywhere the U.S. Navy goes, everything just dies. That would be the same for the navies of any country. And a lot of this stuff is being shifted from the U.S. territorial waters down into the Trans-Tasman Sea, and especially up off the Great Barrier Reef and down here off of Tasmania, because down here they can get away with just about anything. It doesn't have the environmental impact regulations that America territory has. Plus, it's like there's a lot less traffic and visibility down here. They're pretty much free to do whatever they want. And if they look at the ocean as aquanelius, meaning a water with nothing, in the same way that they looked on Australia, then the whales and dolphins either don't exist or they're just biological contaminants to be gotten rid of. But I do remember when I interviewed Peter Eyre, the investigative journalist, a few years ago. He said that when he was in the British Navy, that they would explode depth charges just to kill a bunch of fish so they could then scoop them up and eat them. And then I talked with the guy that had been the Sea Shepherd skipper here in Darwin a few weeks ago, and he said that they, on a Sea Shepherd mission, they deployed these hydroacoustic devices that friends in the Navy had given them in order to deflect the route of a migrating pod of pilot whales, because they tried to direct them away from the Faroe Islands, where they would be, you know, part of that annual slaughter that they have. And so even though it was like doing something bad for a good reason, he still had misgivings about doing it. But just imagine those same technologies in the hands of people that don't want to try to help the whales and dolphins. And then there was another guy, a former military guy that I interviewed in Tasmania back in around 2014. And he talked about these things called bathy bombs that they would deploy. They were disposable instrumentation units that they would drop down in there, and it would send back electromagnetically information, but then they didn't retrieve it, it just stayed down there. I don't think it exploded or anything, but when you think of how much stuff we've got in the ocean, it's unbelievable. And so it's sort of like the sum total of all of our presence is making the ocean, it's degrading the quality of of life there for everybody in the ocean, whether you're talking about chemical or radiological toxicity, the physical presence of shipping and vessels, the noise, the bioacoustics, the just the presence of weapons of all kinds, and then stuff coming from space. And we've also got, Ben Vigen also mentioned the Starlink satellites, that now that astronomers are all up in arms because there's so many. Eventually they want to create a network that covering the space over the entire Earth, like tens of thousands of them. I don't know how many are up now, but I'm trying to get more information now about exactly what kind of energy they're beaming out and what kind of space down onto the Earth it's hitting us with per satellite. So I think that if you want to prove any of this stuff, it's almost impossible. But it's like I keep telling people, well, look, can you show me any articles, any research that has provided definitive proof that smoking cigarettes causes lung cancer? You know, and I'm sure that stuff like that's come up in the court with the tobacco trials back in the 1960s and stuff like that. But what does it mean to prove something versus erring on the side of caution and just assuming that something's not good? But see, we're not going to get rid of the world's militaries. We're not going to get rid of the oil companies. We're not going to get rid of the mining industry or the fishing industry. Why? Because we ourselves are paying for it. And we're all complicit. We drive cars, we eat fish, we pay our taxes that goes to fund the military and stuff. And Elizabeth and I came up with if the whales and dolphins had a big message for us that was the most pragmatic thing they could say that could still help, it was live simply so that others may simply live. And I don't know how many of us are actually making any attempt to do that. That was almost 8 years ago when we came out with it. I've been trying to do it. But everything technologically just keeps going to the next level with all these weapon systems and stuff. And it makes me really sad. But this could be a huge wake-up call for Tasmania, specifically for the people there, to become a lot more aware and active of their island as a maritime, marine, ocean environment, and to actively love the whales and dolphins and the sea life, and to bring them, make them a part of their life, you know? And all the rocks and art I just did in Deloraine, almost all of it had whales and dolphins. But I do think that the whales and dolphins have been beaming us with a lot of really powerful energy. I think that especially here in Australia, they've been beaming healing energy into Australia in the wake of all those fires a few months ago, and trying to help in every way. And I can't say why these pilot whales stranded. I don't think they committed suicide so that they could reincarnate and help us, as my friend in Melbourne suggested. I don't believe that. I don't believe all the airy fairy stuff. I'm the first to admit that I don't know, that we'll probably never know. It may be not just one reason. Their whole experience of death may be completely different from ours. But I ask everybody to please send beautiful prayers for all these pilot whales, and may we all stop participating, being soldiers in World War III, and be the guardians, protectors of life by simplifying our lives in every way. And when you wake up every day, don't go, oh, how am I going to get more shit for myself? How am I going to make more money or get on top of the heap? Go like, how can I be of service to life on Mother Earth and my family of life that's human and non-human? How may I help in it in any way? And could my help be not only from doing something, but maybe from not doing something? So it's a lot to think about, but this thing with the whales in Tasmania, it's a huge wake-up call for the people of Tasmania to realize that you live surrounded by ocean, filled with beautiful beings, and that we've just lost an entire community of whales. And it could be very similar to losing a whole culture of, say, for example, Indigenous Australians, when the last elder passed away that knew their language and their cosmology and their ancient stories. A whole big piece of the puzzle of what it means to be human has been lost. And the same with this whole community or tribe of pilot whales. Their unique perspective, their history, their story, their wisdom may be gone. It might be shared in a vaster collective consciousness of the cetaceans and the other pilot whales. But, you know, I don't know. All this is really interesting stuff to think about. But let's all do our best to live simply so that others may simply live, and to ask not what we can, Mother Earth can do for us, but what we can do or stop doing on her behalf. May all beings be peaceful. May all beings be happy. This is Jeff Phillips Weverson signing off here at sunset on the beach at Dripstone in Darwin, sending all my love to the beautiful whales and my family in Tasmania and Australia and all the Dreamtime ancestors and the chakras of the Rainbow Serpent. Good day.
Thank you. Thank you.